your muscle mass is an organ of longevity. So those muscles, they help with hormones. They help sensitize you to insulin, which means like no diabetes. Let's keep that at bay. And insulin and hormones from your adrenal glands, they're everything. They're the foundation of your hormone health, and you have to have those on point.
Hey, and welcome to another episode of my podcast, and thank you for joining. This show gives you updated knowledge and tools for better well-being, brain health, mental performance, and longevity. You know, I understand your time is valuable, so the goal is to pack these episodes with the latest in science, interesting and inspiring ideas, and actionable tools with my expert guests. If you want to stay updated on new episodes, subscribe to YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, and sign up to my newsletter, inkaland.co/newsletter. Dr. Jolene Bryden, thank you for joining.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Of course, it's a real honor to interview you. You help many women through your books, your education, your channels for optimizing hormones and really balancing and understanding their bodies. So let's talk more about those hormonal problems, hormonal, let's talk about hormones in general.
Let's do it.
So how many women suffer from hormonal problems?
There have been estimates as high as 90% suffer
Whoa.
And so when you consider things like hypothyroidism, insulin resistance or diabetes, any kind of adrenal dysfunction. And then, of course, there is the myriad of what just gets put in the bucket of like lady problems. And then there's, you know, PCOS, polycystic ovarian syndrome. So we've got excess androgen, insulin resistance can be happening. And so when you look at the entire bucket of what is hormones, the estimates are like, it's probably 90%+ of women are experiencing some kind of hormonal issue.
Do you think that this has always been the case? Do you think we have now more or less hormonal problems than before?
That's a great question. So we have to recognize that we are, one, living in an information age. So women can reject the narrative that like, this is just normal. You're just getting old. You're just a mom. You know, all this dismissive language that happens. And they can start to investigate for themselves, identify problems, and bring that to their doctors, where in the past they might not have. We're also seeing women advocate more so that they do get the diagnosis. You know, when we look at something like PCOS, it takes on average 2 to 3 doctors. When we look at endometriosis, it takes most people over 10 years to get that diagnosis. And I talk about all of this in Is This Normal? Now, another piece I want to answer, I do think that we are seeing more hormonal issues come up by way of endocrine disruptors in our environment. And we have to look back over generations and know that our grandmothers and our great-grandmothers didn't have to deal with microplastics. They weren't eating microplastics in fish like we are today. We have inundated our environment with endocrine disruptors. We understand now, I mean, 2 generations ago, we weren't, you know, burning scented candles in our house and having Glade plugins everywhere and making sure that everything was covered in fragrance and then having like, you know, 20+ beauty products that we can be using. Like that wasn't happening. So if people don't know what an endocrine disruptor is, this is a chemical that can attach to receptors, so hormone receptors, and stimulate them in the same way. It can block them. So certain endocrine disruptors like BPA, we can see issues with lower testosterone happening. BPA is what we find in plastics, but also receipt paper. And it's what everybody's marketing now is BPA-free. I just kind of laugh about that because that's just marketing.
So you said that BPA-free plastic is like equally worse than or equally bad as BPA fortified plastic.
Yeah, so if it's the same group as bisphenols, they cause the same problems. It's just that public perception of BPA is it's so bad because there was awareness and education around it. And now we see that at this point, they're marketing BPA free, but they're replacing it with like BPS. We're seeing these other bisphenols come in, and those are just as problematic.
Okay, wow, that's a very good knowledge, good piece of information for sure. So then let's go to these hormonal problems. And as a psychologist, I'm of course interested in how do hormonal imbalances contribute to mental health problems, and what's the link? Like, how can hormones affect, let's say, female hormones? How can they affect your mood and mental health?
Mm-hmm. Well, we understand. So there's actually a lot of ways, right? And we could spend like hours talking about this. So, you know, for example, estrogen is really tied in with serotonin. And as estrogen ebbs and flows through the cycle, so does serotonin. A lot of people recognize this as like the happy neurotransmitter, the happy chemical. Too much of it and you won't be happy. So understand that. So I just want to say that because as I talk about like positive benefits of things, people are always like, more is better. And I'll go supplement with like 5-HTP. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. More is not always better. Progesterone is a big one, especially in the perimenopausal community. So anyone listening, I often get, you know, 30-year-olds who are like, I don't need to know about perimenopause yet. And I'm like, yes, you do. Because it can start as early as age 35. And the first hormone that really starts to go is progesterone. Progesterone is made after ovulation, and it's made in a structure called the corpus luteum. So you have to ovulate, and you need to ovulate regularly. Well, after age 35, cycles can become less regular in terms of ovulation, so anovulatory cycles. And it's not uncommon to see 3 cycles in a year where you just didn't ovulate. Then your progesterone's not right. So what happens when progesterone's not right? Well, progesterone stimulates the GABA receptor in the brain. That helps you feel that sense of calm and also helps you get good sleep. This is why anxiety is one of the symptoms that will come up in the perimenopausal population, and sleep issues. So they'll be offered things like benzodiazepines, which, you know, those may have a time and a place in your life. However, those are some serious medications. So I always look at, well, what is actually going on? And it's usually with a failure of getting those progesterone levels up where they need to be. So progesterone is a really key one. And it can be impacted by stress. So those same stress hormones that make you want to run away or fight, those also affect the brain. And those can cause a panic as well. So epinephrine, norepinephrine. I think what's really important is for people to understand that we've got receptors in our brains for these hormones. And these hormones keep our brain healthy, but they also can be problematic if they're imbalanced. So testosterone, for example, without ample testosterone, we can feel depressed. We can be easy to cry. We can feel that we lack motivation. And you won't normally just see like, that's the only issue. Whenever I talk about low testosterone, people are always like, oh, that's going to be my libido, right? Yeah, but it may have started with you feeling sad and not feeling motivated. And then like, of course, like we're going to have the libido issues, but we also may have muscle mass issues taking place as well. There might be inflammation, immune system dysregulation that's connected to that testosterone piece. And of course, anytime we're talking about hormones and brain health, we have to recognize that hormones also help modulate the immune system. And if we've got hormone issues that are lending itself to immune system that wants to throw off inflammatory cytokines, these are the chemical messengers of the immune system, that can lead to feelings of depression as well by disrupting that serotonin pathway. And again, the answer isn't more serotonin. It's actually like we have to put out the fire in the brain. The last hormone I really want to point out when it comes to psychological health is thyroid hormone. And I feel like this one is majorly overlooked. You will, in my clinical experience, psychologists and psychiatrists and people in the mental health space, they're very good at identifying we should get thyroid hormone tested. They're actually, I find that entire community and that field is great about saying, let's test thyroid hormone, let's test vitamin D. Like they're ahead of things like that. Whereas the average primary care doctor or gynecologist, they might be like, yeah, you're sad because you just had a baby, or yeah, you're sad and you're having these issues. Let's get you on an SSRI. And that's not that SSRIs are like bad, but if that's not treating the thyroid disorder, then that SSRI is not going to work. And now they're, you know, that's when I'll get patients sometimes that are on a drug cocktail and I test their thyroid and I'm like, and that's after saying like, How's your digestion? Oh, it's really slow. I'm constipated. How's your skin? Oh, it's been really dry. I'm losing hair. Oh, how is your body temperature? Do you notice that you're the coldest person in the room? Yeah, I am. Or my hands and feet are always cold. Thyroid is going to affect every system in your body, and it won't show up the same way for everyone. We test thyroid, and there it is. I had a patient who had a TSH of 15. That's thyroid stimulating hormone. That shouldn't be above 5, ideally not above 2.5. It was 15, and she was on 3 different psychiatric meds to treat depression. And really, the issue was is that she didn't have enough thyroid hormone.
So progesterone, testosterone, and thyroid, those were the 3 hormones that you pointed out as, hey, if you have mental health issues, which may be related to hormonal imbalance, these may underlie. And I love that you highlighted testosterone because, of course, this is not often talked about when we talk about female hormones that we also need. Mm-hmm. We also have testosterone. Can you explain or tell how testosterone is made in our body and what processes does it mediate? What does it affect to?
Yeah, so testosterone, you're right. It gets called the male sex hormone, which is so silly because there is no male or female hormones, which I think blows a lot of people's minds. People are like, wait, I was taught this. Like, I was taught this in sex ed. Like, there's the boy hormones and the girl hormones. That's not true. We have all these hormones. They're just in different balances. Some are more free than others to stimulate tissues. And then we have our genes, right, that respond to those hormones in a certain way. Testosterone, as I talk about in Is This Normal, it is made in the ovaries, but it's also made in the adrenal glands. And this is really important to understand that the adrenal glands produce DHEA, and DHEA goes into a pathway where it can become estrogen or testosterone. Now, as we were talking about with like mental health, if you're in the latter part of your perimenopausal years or you're crossing that threshold into menopause, the estrogen levels being low can also lead to depression as well. It also can lead to dementia-like symptoms, which is really concerning. When you get to that stage, it's going to be your adrenal glands that you really rely on to produce that DHEA, and that's where you're going to be getting testosterone and estrogen from because your ovaries are no longer producing them. So with testosterone is really important. So yes, everybody, definitely sexual desire, it plays a role. If you have low sexual desire from your perspective, does that mean you need testosterone? Not necessarily. You may have a totally normal sexual desire classified as responsive desire, which is where you have, you basically have to get stress levels low, get a partner on point, work on relationship issues. And I talk about this, there's a circular model of arousal. When it comes to women, it's a lot more complex. And so to understand that your sexual desire might be totally normal, and I go through a whole chapter of a quiz on this, everything, and I take you through it in the program as well for you to understand that most of the time you're normal and you don't actually need testosterone. Now, there are situations where like you're postmenopausal, you do need testosterone for that, or you're on hormonal birth control and that's dropping your testosterone production and increasing sex hormone binding globulin, a protein that grabs onto your testosterone. And research has found that these women who complain of low libido and they're on the pill, they do actually respond to DHEA replacement therapy. We're too early in the research to know, should we be putting everybody who complains about this on DHEA? We can't say that at this point. We don't have enough research, but there has been benefit shown. And so that is to say there is a time and place for testosterone in the sexual desire conversation, but it's not usually the go-to. Now, the other part of testosterone is that it's really important for muscle mass. And this is, I think, another area where we get inundated with the messaging as women of like, oh, lifting heavy weights is not sexy. Building muscle is not, like, who cares? Who cares what people think is sexy, okay? Well, let me tell you that your muscle mass is an organ of longevity. So those muscles, they help with hormones. They help sensitize you to insulin, which means like no diabetes. Let's keep that at bay. And insulin and your hormone or your hormones from your adrenal glands, they're everything. As I explained it in Is This Normal? They're the foundation of your hormone health, and you have to have those on point. Now, muscle mass is also going to help so that we have good bone density, so that we are metabolically fit. And so testosterone is playing a role in that as well. Testosterone also plays a role in the immune system and inflammation regulation. So it's important in that regard. And truly, like, there's a lot more about testosterone in the women's body that we don't understand. So is this normal? I actually say, like, here's what we know based on men. And we don't have the research for women. So we're trying to piece this together of, like, we have no, there's times where, like, research on men is, it's silly to think, like, you just apply that to women. Like, and that happens a lot and it's very problematic. But then there's also times where, like, we explore and we learn things about testosterone, for example, and we can understand that blood sugar dysregulation, that endocrine disruptors, that all of these things negatively impact testosterone. There's no reason to think it wouldn't also do that in a woman's body because of the way that those hormones work and the way they're set up.
Okay. So what are some typical, what is typical hormonal symptoms or the symptoms that your hormones are in balance versus that this is normal as a woman who has fluctuating level of female and male hormones? Now I used that, but let's say fluctuating levels of sex hormones, because we may experience different things according to our cycles, for example. But what is normal and what is not normal?
Yeah, okay, so talking specifically about the cycle, let's just start with, like, what's normal. So if we start from the top with a period, I think that's just about how everybody learns about their cycle is with the period, because it's, like, the easy, like, you know when you're on your period, right? So with your period should be anywhere from 3 to 7 days. If it's less than 3 and it's really light, that could be a sign that you have low estrogen. With your period, it's normal to feel a little bit tired, but you shouldn't be, like, laid out, exhausted, can't get out of bed. Same with your cramps. We're often told, like, period pain is normal. To a point, like, your uterus is working to contract and shed the uterine lining. But if you can't get out of bed, you're crying in pain, you have to take, you know, ibuprofen, you know, round the clock, this is problematic. And I've had pushback from young women on social media saying, no, everyone's threshold of pain is different. So that could be normal. And I'm like, okay, that needs to stop. Like, that idea needs to stop, because it doesn't matter what your friend experiences or what anyone else experiences, like, it's about what's true for you. And if that's what's true for you, we need to investigate. But I feel like that's really, like, internalized medical gaslighting, where we've been told, like, oh, period pain is just, like, the way it is. And so women are like, oh, you know, if she's, like, experiencing period pain, she probably has a lower threshold of pain. I have seriously heard doctors say that. I've had patients come to me saying, my doctor just said, I just had a lower threshold for pain and that's what the problem was. And we work it up and I'm like, no, you actually have fibroids, or you have endometriosis. You actually have a medical condition, and we just need to believe women about what their story is about living in their body. So that's the period piece. As you move through your cycle, you're moving towards ovulation. Now, at that point, your estrogen's rising. You should feel, as you near ovulation, I talk about this in the book, there's actually a study that says there's, like, basically, like, this 6-day sexual window where women are much more in the mood. And that's because estrogen's rising, testosterone's rising, and we should be feeling more energy and we should be feeling good. If you are having headaches during that time, that's not normal. That can be an estrogen issue. If you have pain when you ovulate, that is something that could be normal, but depending on the degree of it, it could be a sign of something like endometriosis, or we've got something going on with the ovary. So we never want to just ignore that. Following ovulation, that's where we start to get into the luteal phase. Well, we do get into the luteal phase. That's really, I wanted to say, we start to get into that progesterone feel good phase. Of course, though, if progesterone's not right, if you're not getting those levels up, or if your estrogen levels are not optimized in balance with progesterone, your estrogen should be up in that part of the cycle, but progesterone really is taking the lead there. We can see issues with irritability, bloating, breast tenderness, feeling, that we are starving and hungry, like that can be actually normal. So I want people to understand that cravings are actually normal, but Anything that drives you to feel like you have to compulsively eat or binge eat, that's not normal. But we do see metabolic shifts and then the changes in serotonin as well. It's the estrogen and serotonin change that happens in the later half of the cycle that you're like, I really need a cookie. I really need chocolate. I need sugar. And that's because that's going to give you a little serotonin boost. And your brain's like, thank you. I needed to feel better for a second. So if you do that, you're not a bad person. Understand their chemistry. Is working towards, we might have a baby here. So let's like start to get calories up and let's start to store. And that is normal to a degree, but these feelings that I can't sleep, I wake up feeling hot and sweaty, I'm having headaches, all the other symptoms I described, and feeling like that constellation of like PMS symptoms, or the more extreme, which is PMDD, where you have very extreme mood issues going on along with some physical symptoms. None of that is normal. And much of that can be mediated with nutrition and lifestyle practices that I'm talking about in my book. I also talk about, for anybody with PMDD listening, I talk about in my book, like connections between ADHD and autism and PMDD, and how we really need to not just label someone and then forget about it. This I see a lot, where my patients are labeled as PMDD, and then they're sent along their way. And then I'm asking them about things, and they're benefiting from wearing earplugs. They can't have tags touching them. They find they get overstimulated by light very easily. Noises, they have auditory processing. They feel like they have they're exhausted in social settings, that, you know, all of these things I'm talking about, these can be signs of autism. There's the inability to focus as well, or you're hyper-focusing, and these other symptoms that can be signs of ADHD. Now, I am not a mental health professional, so I don't diagnose these, but I look for the signs of this, because what we know is the autism, so the neurodivergent bucket of women actually experience PMDD at a higher rate. So we have to ask what's going on with that. We also know that women with PCOS, they tend to have a higher incidence of ADHD. So instead of just labeling and be like, we're done, this is it, this is your label, we have to ask more questions, because I can't tell you how many of my patients have been diagnosed with PMDD, and then we get them over to someone who actually knows how to work up a woman for autism, and we find out she's actually autistic. Like, she's on that autism spectrum, and she's part of that bucket, which is like very complex and a whole other conversation that I'm certainly not an expert in. However, the same symptoms that are coming up during that luteal phase, in people who are already diagnosed with autism or ADHD, I see that their symptoms are worse in the luteal phase. In fact, my patients will say, my ADHD medication doesn't even work as I'm getting close to my period. In fact, that's all normal, because it's the way that your hormones are fluctuating and the way your brain is already perceiving things. And this is where I really like to highlight, whatever your diagnosis is, if you're listening right now, understand that as someone with cyclical hormones that are happening over this, you know, month-ish period, you're not the problem. You've never been the problem. The problem is that we live in a society that is set up on the male archetype, which is this 24-hour cyclical creature, not this, you know, 28-plus-ish day cyclical creature, and that we don't hold space in society, unless you're in Spain, you now can take time off for your period, but we don't hold space for the fact that, like, these hormonal changes are happening. They're not in any way inhibiting us, so to speak. It's just, we need grace and space to make adjustments in our life. So with my patients that, they're going into the later part of their luteal phase, and we know they're in the neurodivergent category, like, weighted blankets. Yes. earplugs. Yes, let's make sure that like we are limiting social time. A lot of women feel that way already as it is. I got to limit social time. So, you know, we're talking about what is and isn't normal in the cycle. And I think that's just a very important nuanced part of the conversation that's not getting enough attention and not being talked about enough.
Yeah, definitely. One issue that I feel like we have in the society is that also these things are not really recognized in workplaces. Like women are stressed over work a lot more than men. Increased work hours, working hours really contribute to depression and anxiety and chronic stress in women. But asking for a few days off because you are on your period or because you are going towards your period, that's like very unknown. And yeah. If anything, we are just like encouraged to push through and push more. And we're going into this society, into this ideology more and more where women and men are doing the same things all the time without acknowledging mm-hmm. that our bodies are maybe not designed like that. We're maybe not yeah. supposed to be pushing all the time.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other thing I think we all should consider is that it doesn't mean that like, there's always this standard of like, keep up with your male counterpart and women are as equal to men. And I'm not in any way saying that your hormones make you the lesser. They absolutely do not. There's a lot of ways they give you strength and they give you an edge over the male counterpart that, I mean, they could just never. But it's things like, can we just adjust that you could work from home if that's possible? Can you work from home, you know, during your luteal phase? And it's not to say that like you can't go and work. Like, listen, like the US Soccer Cup, they you know, or the women's team, they took the cup. Okay, so that cup is in their hands. The gal who made that scored the goal that won it all started her period the next day. Okay, so like, you can do amazing things. I think that it's just about giving yourself permission to pause in other ways and recognizing that like, if it comes up to work, it comes to work and you're like, I gotta work, I gotta push, like I have this deadline, I have to make it happen. What can you shift in your personal life? Can you get more sleep? So the things you actually need to tweak, your employer doesn't have to know anything about it. So instead of like, you know, going to bed at 11 p.m. and waking up at like 5 a.m., could you shift to where like you, if you still have to get up at 5 a.m., can you go to bed at like 9 or even 10? And that can make all the difference for your body in where you're at. I talk about in the book, like you're going to find in your luteal phase, like progesterone is saying, go to sleep. That's what progesterone's, it's like, not just go to sleep, get deep restorative sleep. And I take you through like how to get better sleep because that's going to make all the difference. When you get into your pre-ovulation phase of the follicular phase of your cycle, that is where you're going to be like, how do I have, I got 6 hours of sleep. And like, how am I going? How do I feel fine? That is something to honor and respect. If you wake up and you're like, I have to drink 4 cups of coffee, I can't even get through the day. Like your adrenals have a problem. Like there's a problem there. And that doesn't mean like, I see people all the time in the health and wellness space who are like, just give up your coffee. Like don't drink coffee. It's the devil. We have to recognize that like people have rituals and there's little things that like make them happy, but also lasting change doesn't happen immediately. And while 4 cups of coffee may not be working for you, we have to come up with a plan to meet people where they're at and to titrate things back. So like we want to gradually reduce the coffee while also helping you support stress reduction practices, making sure you're getting magnesium and B vitamins coming in. Maybe you need adaptogenic herbs. Like we need to be taking this approach that is supporting people where they're at and recognizing that you don't have to have, you know, your cycle hindering you, but you can make little shifts and changes so that you can feel so much better and you can keep achieving your goal. So there are times where I will have people say like, oh, you're just reducing women to their hormones and you're just saying that like they can't do things and that's so anti-women. And I'm like, no, I'm just saying, don't be looking at the male archetype that we're all told is the standard, the gold standard to which we should measure and live our life by. And instead say, what is true for me? What do I need to adjust and fix for myself? And really honor that, because we have been told, not only in society, but in medicine as well. I mean, gosh, how many, like you go back through history, how many times it has been, here's the male body. It is the standard of perfection. And here's the, female inferior version that also makes babies. Like, oh my God, we make babies. Like you could never male body, like make a baby, like a whole human and then feed it and then run on no sleep somehow and like keep going. Like, so understand that I am not saying that anyone is better or worse, but what I'm trying to play to is the idea that medicine and society as a whole have told us we should live up to this male standard, and it's never worked and it's not going to work. And instead, I want you to figure out what works best for you and set your own standard of being.
Yeah, for sure. And I kind of feel like, who is to say, why do we even think that something like being super strong and working a lot and making money and those things, like being in a high motivated, high achieving state all the time, is somehow superior than rest and recovery. I think they are,
yeah,
they are both good.
Or
both
fun. Need them. Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like, I mean, I have definitely struggled this as well of like, oh, I need to be in a state of, I have been inundated with messaging of a capitalistic market my entire life. So I struggle with this, like, oh my God, am I being productive? What have I accomplished today? But I will have to say one of the best gifts I've ever given myself is an Oura ring, which tracks my data and tracks everything. And I actually, so this, if people follow me on Instagram, they saw I had mastitis on Sunday, which is like a bacterial infection in your breast. And it's awful. It's like one of the worst. You feel awful when you have it.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I mean, it's like comes with the breastfeeding territory when your toddler decides to jump off the couch and he lands his knee into your breast. Like that trauma, that's gonna happen. Like, and that's unfortunate. However, I laid there, I rested. Even when I was feeling better, I was like, no, I'm just like, I want to get up and do stuff. I just need to rest more. Seeing my Oura ring data of my heart rate variability went up. So that means your stress was down. And like, this is a really good health marker. My deep sleep was even better. When I look at all of these markers, so like it took mastitis kicking my ass and putting me down for me to see this. But I learned a long time ago, like don't wait until you get sick. This is just a recent example. But to see that when I am not doing, like I'm not productive, I'm just hanging out, how good my biomarkers look in terms of stress, of sleep, even body temperature, like it all starts to optimize. And what that speaks to is the resiliency of your body and how even just taking some time to rest can help your body work it out and recalibrate on its own. As we were talking about, like stress is so, I mean, it's so bad for hormones. It's so bad for the body. It's so bad for mental health. And yet I feel like it just hasn't been explained to people well enough and in a way where what we say really matches what society is expecting. So we're like, stress is bad. And then society is like, be productive, work harder. And it's just this mismatch. Like we talked about at the very beginning, it's a mismatch that doesn't work with our hormones.
There is a lot to chew on here. Like there are so many things that women have to go through in their mind and think like, is this okay? Is this okay that I rest? Is this okay that I'm not productive all the time? Is this okay that I have this cycle and I have these issues, or I have a hormonal symptom? And somehow I feel like of course there is a lot of shame as well, related still in 2022, still related to hormones and hormonal cycle and being a woman, I guess. But I often think that, you know, being a woman is my superpower. My hormones are my superpower. They make me very sensitive to my internal messages. They alarm me if something's going awry. They help me to recognize when I need to take more rest and recovery, when I can push more, when I need socializing, when I need more fun, when I need less work. So you can take it as my hormones are again preventing me of doing this and that productive, or you can think it as, oh, my hormones are there to inform me. Oops, my headphone dropped.
It made it that far.
So my hormones are there to inform me that they are like a biosensor that's installed in my body, and that's amazing.
Absolutely. So, no, that's so, so well said, because that's exactly what it is. And as a woman, you are super in tune with the environment, because with, you know, your entire system, whether you choose to have a baby or not, whether you are, you know, struggling in some way to conceive or not, like, the system was set up with that in mind. And so regardless of baby status, your body has to sense the environment and understand if it's safe or not safe, and then adjust to that. And I think we have been, you know, I know we've been inundated with messages that say to us, ignore your intuition, ignore those messages, push ahead, just keep going. And that's really a conversation that I want to shift with, is this normal? And I want to provide women. So in the book, there are tools to help you navigate all of this that we have been talking about. And if you go to drbright.com/isthisnormal, I actually have put together a really comprehensive ebook. It's a cookbook that has recipes and meal plans. So it's going to take you through not just like, you know, a meal plan of like, this is how you should eat, but it's, here are the foods that can help you with where you're at in your cycle to support your hormones. And the recipes, we give descriptions of like, this is providing B6, and that's going to help your corpus luteum produce progesterone. And so this is when we want to start bringing this in. And it's these little tweaks that you can start to make to your nutrition, building that nutrient density, starting to be honest in the conversations about how is your sleep? How are your endocrine disruptors exposure? How is your stress? How are your relationships? All of these kinds of things, I think they get discounted a lot, and we don't really give them the respect that they deserve in terms of how much power you have as an individual to impact your life and to change your hormones for the better.
I love that. I love that cookbook idea. Actually, can we talk about those foods? Can we talk about, let's go through the hormonal cycle and think about what we can do and eat at certain points of the hormonal cycle to really support our hormonal balance. Maybe there are some supplements as well that could benefit in certain times of the month.
Absolutely. So in the, and in this, so people understand, like, this is, I think right now I looked at, there's close to 60 recipes. So this is a like cookbook. It's a digital cookbook. And it goes along with supporting you on the Is This Normal journey. And in this book, so we're going to start with the week one is the period phase. And understand that if you're not cycling because you have PCOS, functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, your postmenopause, it doesn't matter. You can start at day one, it's still going to support your hormones, because it also works to support your adrenal glands, your insulin regulation, and your thyroid as well. And so in the period phase, we're really looking at bringing in those iron-rich foods, those foods that have folate, B12 in them, because that's how we're going to rebuild red blood cells. And we're losing iron through our menstrual blood. We need those nutrients for our thyroid to function optimally. And our thyroid is going to be crucial. Getting us to ovulation helps with the follicle development. Not a lot of people talk about this. They talk about like your brain hormones and estrogen, everything you need to develop a follicle, but we have to be taking care of, so people who might not know, I shouldn't just glaze over that. Follicle is where the egg is going to develop. And so we want to help with that follicular development and the maturation of the egg. So we have to take care of the thyroid in that time. So there are options. So people who are vegetarian know there are vegetarian options in there as well. And I really encourage people, like, get the meal plan, look at the recipes, and start to look at like what fits for you. The recipes are gluten-free and dairy-free options. And so you've got to really just look at like, I want you to own this, like, and know that we're not all going to have the same taste. So you might be like, I need more seasoning, or I need less seasoning. So, and that's okay. Like, you don't have to be completely rigid. So in the beginning, we're going to be bringing in, so meats are a great way to bring in the B12 and a really highly absorbable form of iron. We're also going to be looking at, you know, really throughout the entire menstrual cycle, making sure we get cruciferous vegetables coming in. And there's a lot of plants in this meal plan because that fiber is going to help with your gut microbiome. Is this normal? We didn't get into like how your gut health impacts your hormone health and how that impacts your vaginal health. Like it's all connected. And so we want to be making sure that we're eating those cruciferous vegetables. And really, as we move into the later half of the follicular phase, so we're leaving the period, we're going into the next week, that's when we're incorporating lighter foods. We usually want to eat a little bit lighter at that point in our cycle. So we're looking at bringing in more salads. By the way, there are dessert recipes. There's one that's a super seed chocolate bark that I'm actually going to be making people for Christmas. I'll make some variations to try to like make it a little more festive. These are definitely recipes that I'm like, you can incorporate them into your daily life. There's desserts in there, and you can also share these things with other people because they're incredibly delicious. So as we are going into the ovulatory phase, you know, we're going to want to, so you're going to find avocados in this meal plan. Avocados are such an excellent source of fat, but they're also going to give you vitamin B6 and magnesium, two nutrients that women definitely need. So around ovulation and leading up to that, we want to start bringing up vitamin C levels, vitamin B6. We want to have magnesium on point. We're incorporating seed cycling in this program. So as part of the first half, you're going to be eating flax seeds and pumpkin seeds. As you go past ovulation, we switch to sesame seeds and sunflower seeds and really unique ways of using these besides putting them in a smoothie or putting them into oatmeal. And then as we enter the luteal phase, we've got to focus on getting those cruciferous vegetables in because we have to help that estrogen detox. And your liver and your gut and your kidneys are excellent at detoxifying your estrogen and making healthy metabolites when they're provided with the right nutrients. And so that's what we want to make sure that we're doing. So you'll find broccoli sprouts in the recipes as well. Sulforaphane is amazing. In the research, it is so protective against damage that estrogen can be doing to your DNA. It is protective of your ovaries, of your breast. I mean, it's, I'm like, can we all just eat our sprouts? It's so, so beneficial to have those coming in. And we
what
also
do you think about
be looking
sulforaphane,
at like,
what do you think about sulforaphane supplement in replacement of sprouts?
Yes,
because
so,
some people may find it hard to find sprouts, or they try sprouting and may find that the sprouts get molded, talking about experience here. So yeah. Is the supplement any good?
I live in the tropics, and I had great broccoli sprouts like going. I was doing all the sprouts. I had a whole batch get infested by fruit fly larvae. It was nasty.
Yeah.
I was like, I have to take a break. I have a farmer's market here. I'm just going to go spend all my money on sprouts because it's not cheap. You can do sprouts in a jar in a fridge, and that can help cut down on mold. But like, I'm right there with you.
Oh,
so I do supplement as well, because your diet you can't be perfect with your diet, and you can't not go crazy trying to be perfect with your diet. I think that it becomes really problematic in the health space when we're like, your diet needs to be perfect and it's so rigid. Like you can't be that way. Like life happens. So our balanced women's hormone support, it has DIM in it, which you'll also get from cruciferous vegetables. And it has sulforaphane and an enzyme in that formulation from mustard seed that helps the sulforaphane work even better. And so that combination, it actually comes with B vitamins and vitamin C and Vitex as well, because all of these things really help optimize hormones. So yes, to a supplement. And when it comes to DIM and sulforaphane, that is something that I recommend supplementing throughout the cycle. Remember when we said, everybody listening, when I said, hey, more is not better, that is true for DIM. DIM really is ideally supplemented at 50 to 100 milligrams a day. More is not better. When you are passing that 100 milligram mark, that's where we start to see headaches. People can have hot flashes. You're pushing your estrogen out too fast. So just want people to be aware of that, because I know I will get people that are like, I felt awful with DIM. And I'm like, what DIM were you taking? They were taking like 500 milligrams of DIM. I'm like, that's too much. Like estrogen's not so bad that we're like, get it out. Like we have to have that balance. So, you know, as you were talking about with supplements, so I talked about, you know, having the B vitamins, having Vitex on board, having vitamin C. Again, that's going to support the corpus luteum, vitamin B6 specifically. Great for the ovaries in producing progesterone. Vitamin B5, great for the adrenal glands. Your adrenal glands and your ovaries both love vitamin C. And in fact, your adrenal glands are one of the highest concentrated tissues with vitamin C. They really, really need vitamin C. So those are some of the supplements that you can bring in that can be helpful. As I talked before, adaptogenic herbs might be helpful for helping you modulate your cortisol, modulate those stress hormones, how the adrenal glands are functioning and really supporting them. And it is something too that, like, depending on sleep, if you're struggling with sleep, bringing in something like passion flower might be helpful in that luteal phase, because it's gonna work on that GABA pathway, which is gonna help you stay asleep. So everybody's like, melatonin. And I'm like, melatonin can be great. It's an antioxidant, great for the brain, great for the ovaries, can help you go to sleep, will not help you stay asleep. That's really where the GABA piece comes through. And that's why when your progesterone's low, you may be able to fall asleep. You may have racing thoughts and not be able to, but you might not be able to stay asleep. So that's where something as simple as like passion flower tea or L-theanine, which I recommend supplementing with it. It comes from green tea, but that also has caffeine. And so you don't want to be sipping green tea before you go to bed.
That was a very good list of things. One topic that I really want to go into and talk about is the pill. Because so mm-hmm. just as a background, I've never been on the pill, but I know many women are. And there are a lot of things that the pill can do in our bodies and cause in our body. How many percentage of women are prescribed the pill?
So, you know, it depends on what we're seeing and what, you know, what is going on in different countries. Like, it varies, but it's estimated in the United States that 11 million women are currently taking the pill. And there's been estimates saying as high as 58% are taking it for other reasons than just pregnancy prevention. So when you are looking at pill use, there's the people that use it for pregnancy prevention primarily, but there's the other people who are like, they're told this can help your acne, this can help with your irregular periods, this can help with like really all these hormone symptoms, and it can prevent pregnancy. So, you know, when we look at that, we really have to ask the question, is this the best tool for that individual? It's one tool. I love that we have the option. I think we need to guard this option fiercely, and women do need access to it, but we do need to ask for the individual, is this the best thing for them? So for example, putting young women on the pill for period pain, this is something I actually, you know, was in a conversation with a doctor, and I was like, you know, it's not necessarily always the best option, and there's other things. And she was like, oh, so we're just supposed to let them suffer. Like, you don't even care. You just want to let them suffer. I'm like, no one said them suffer. What I'm saying is they could take the pill, or maybe they need some magnesium. Maybe they need some omega-3 fatty acids, or maybe they have endometriosis or something else going on, and giving them the pill without ever having that conversation is dismissing them from getting the care they need. Again, labeling people, or, you know, pseudo fixing problems, like we've gotten rid of the symptom, but have we really gotten rid of what else is going on? And to that, she was like, I never really thought about how we're like, we just want to get them out of pain. I get that. Yes, of course we want to get them out of pain, but like, we're not having that deeper conversation about, is there anything else that we also should be looking for?
Mm. Can you explain how the pill works for maybe those who have not been on the pill or have been prescribed it and doesn't actually know what they are doing and what they are taking?
Yeah. So there's three mechanisms by which the pill works. And the primary one is to disrupt brain ovarian communication. So basically a negative feedback cycle, flood the system with hormones. Brain says we're good on hormones, don't make any. And that means the brain is not going to signal to the ovary. So brain, no signaling to the ovary. So that's the primary mechanism. Works at the brain level to stop communication between brain and ovary so that ovulation doesn't occur. Perfect if you don't want a baby, right? Now, it also works by thinning the endometrial lining. So the lining of your uterus can become thinner over time, which is why some women, they stop having bleeds while they're on the period, on the pill, what people will call a period, but not quite a period, okay? You're not going through the whole menstrual cycle. You're not ovulating, all of that. It is, and this language I think is important because we so often say to women, you need a period. Periods are important. Like they're a gauge of your overall health. And then when you're on the pill, we're like, oh, you don't need a period. I'm like, what happened? Well, it's not actually a period. And because the endometrial lining is becoming thin, you don't actually need to shed it. So you might lose your period altogether, or you may skip it because that endometrial buildup, the buildup of the tissue, that's not happening like it would in a natural, no hormone, a no synthetic hormone environment. We don't worry about that. And then the other thing the pill does is that it can shift cervical mucus, the progestin that's in there. It's not progesterone, but it's progestin. That can shift cervical mucus so that it actually blocks the sperm from being able to make its way to the egg should that mechanism fail. But we understand that, you know, with the pill, with perfect use, we're going to have about 99% efficacy. With the typical use, it's around 97%. So if you're like, why would we even ovulate? I thought it was 99% effective, like we're all told. Well, it depends on how you're using it. The typical user isn't going to see that high of an efficacy rate because we're just not perfect. We're not designed to be perfect.
Yeah. The fact that most of the women are using it for non-contraceptive means is like a pretty shocking to me, just considering what I've read about the pill and the side effects. What are some of the typical side effects? Or I kind of want to know, is it safe? In your opinion, in your personal, professional, clinical opinion, do you think pill is safe to use?
I think it depends on the metrics that we're measuring. There's no reason to say that like this is a dangerous medication. I certainly see people saying that after Beyond the Pill came out, people who already had a bias are like, this just proves that this is the most toxic drug out there. And I'm like, it's definitely not the most toxic drug out there. I just kind of laugh because there's drugs that have been pulled from the market that are certainly much, much worse. But with that, you know, I think that we have to look at the individual. So like if you have a history of clotting issues, that could be dangerous for you because you can end up with a stroke, pulmonary embolism, like this could be life-threatening. When it comes to depression, and we see rates of suicidal ideation happening among teens, if you already have a history of depression, if you have a family history of depression, there's no research on ACE scores, adverse childhood events, but we know those people are at higher risk for depression. So the pill may not have an effect on you, or it could lead to adverse mood symptoms, and suicidal ideation is definitely a life-threatening issue. So in general, it's not that like, oh, it's just dangerous. It's definitely an important tool. I think controlling our reproductive health, arguably the science, the studies that have been done have shown women graduate college at a higher rate. We've advanced careers. Like there's a lot of good the introduction of the pill has done for us. And yet the conversation about how safe it is needs to be made at the individual level. For some women, it's the best thing that they've ever taken. It changes their life. They finally feel this cloud has lifted. They're not dealing with PMS. Like their mood is so much better. Their periods are so much better and they're thriving in life. And then there are other women who don't have that experience. And those are the conversations that are not happening. We're not having that individualized conversation with the informed consent of explaining what could possibly happen with this individual, given their family history, given their personal medical history.
Yeah, so as with everything, as with supplements, as with whatever lifestyle interventions, also the pill is individual and its response is individual. Is there some long-term consequences, let's say, if you go into a pill and you come out of it, and let's say you get some side effects or something, you said it thins the endometrium in your uterus, does those normalize when you come out of the pill?
Let's start and talk about how the pill is used for symptom management. And I think what's really missing in this conversation, so the biggest question I get is women saying, I think the pill caused my infertility, or I am infertile because of the pill. And when we go through the history, we understand that, okay, actually for you, you were having severely painful periods. They were heavy. You were vomiting sometimes because of your period pain, and you were put on the pill. And you come off 2 decades later wanting to have a baby, and now you're unable to. Well, as it turns out, you actually had endometriosis. Nobody tested you, treated you, or even talked to you about endometriosis. That is associated with infertility. So the problem is that you've had endometriosis this whole time. And now that you've come off the pill, it's finally apparent that there is a problem. And this is where, you know, so we'll see the pill prescribed to young women. Okay. We're not going to have conversations about whether you want to have a baby or not at 14, right? Not a conversation we're having. When women are, you know, in their 20s, that is a time as well they'll get prescribed the pill. We should have that conversation. Do you think you might want to have a baby in the future? They're coming in with problems. Like, they're saying, my periods are really irregular and they've always been this way. And I'm finding that, like, I have trouble with my weight, or maybe I'm having depression, anxiety. Like, these can be signs of polycystic ovarian syndrome, rather than just saying, oh, you don't want a baby right now. Okay, here's the pill. I'll see you when you do. We need to say, okay, so I want you to understand that, like, we do have the pill. This is one intervention. Before we do that, I want to work you up. I want to see, like, could this be polycystic ovarian syndrome? Could this be something else going on? The same true with FHA, so functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, women losing their period from overtraining, under eating, really significant stress in their life, putting them on the pill just for the sake of getting them to bleed. It's not going to protect their health, and it's not going to help us understand, did we bring in the right interventions for her to recover her period? And so all of this is to say, these are the problems leading to infertility. These are the problems that are making it so that women struggle to get pregnant when they come off the pill. But we're all told, don't worry about it. It doesn't affect your fertility. So when you come off, you'll be able to get pregnant. While it may not be affecting your fertility, that blanket statement of when you come off, you should be able to get pregnant, that's a more nuanced conversation. If you're having symptoms, we should understand why, and we should work on that piece. So I want people to understand, it's not that the pill caused you to become infertile. It's that you had these pre-existing conditions. Now, with the thinning of the endometrial lining, there are small studies that need to be repeated. Could changes happen with the uterus? As of right now, it doesn't appear that that's the case, but there have been small speculative studies that we definitely need more research on. When it comes to the mood issues, that doesn't always just reverse just because you come off birth control. People do say, like, within 6 weeks, within 3 months of coming off the pill, yes, my mood started to lift. Other people are like, no, things got better, but I'm not 100% of who I used to be. And it's interesting language when you listen to women who will say, like, I went on the pill and I just didn't feel like myself. And then when I came off, I recognized myself again. And this is something, rather than, I think people really love to be like, that means the pill is the devil, it is so bad. Or, like, we shouldn't even listen to these women because, you know, they're questioning birth control and that's, like, anti-women, we don't do that. Rather than those conversations, I think we should meet that with curiosity of, like, that's interesting. What do we think was going on there? What do we think could have been happening for this individual? And how do we expand that knowledge so that we can have better conversations with our patients?
Mm. Yeah, thank you. Very good balanced view on the pill, and very good explanation for us all to understand better that it's not all devil, as you said, and it can be very good for someone who really needs it. Okay, before we go into your links and where people can find you, my final question is, what would be something that you would want to tell all women? What is something that you really want all women to understand in terms of their hormonal balance and health?
It's much, I think, of what we've been talking about, which is that your hormones are made to give you superpowers and that you're not the problem. Like when we're talking about, is this normal? There are things that are not normal, but many of the things that we've been led to believe are normal are not normal. They're myths. And you need to be really understanding that you're not the problem, okay? Our society is set up in a very problematic way that has made you think you're the problem, whether it is, you know, related to your sexual desire and your sexual function, to needing to rest more because you're on your period. Any of these things that we're told, like, you're a problem because of that, is not true. And you should not internalize that. And I would definitely encourage you to meet your body with curiosity, understanding that there is a normal that's true for you, and that's the only normal that matters. It doesn't matter how anyone else feels, what anyone else has experienced, or what your doctor says your experience should be. If it's not normal for you, then that's what matters.
I love it. Thank you. It's like, you're not the problem, you are the solution. So, good yes. message. Thank you. So, Dr. Jolene Brighton, it has been a great pleasure chatting with you today. I've learned so much, and I'm sure all the listeners have as well. Please tell us everything about where we can find your stuff, because you have amazing content, a wealth of knowledge, and we can all learn a lot more from you. So where can we find it?
My main hub is drbrighton.com, drbrighten.com. And if you go to /isthisnormal, for everybody who grabs a copy of Is This Normal, we've got that extra cookbook bonus for you, plus some other goodies that are definitely worth checking out. And then you can find me across social media at Dr. Jolene Brighton. That's Dr. Jolene Brighton. I'm on TikTok, I'm on Instagram, and you'll find me on YouTube as well.
Thank you for listening. I'd love to hear what questions and ideas you got from today's episode, so leave a comment on YouTube and let me know about you. If you liked this episode, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcast. This also helps with podcast ranking and visibility. If you know someone who might benefit from listening to today's episode, consider sharing it with them and spreading health. Looking forward to having you around next time as well. Subscribe to get notified on the next episode. See you next time at the same place. Have a great rest of the week.